Gotcha. Hey, I'm Danielle Smith, here today for Leonard Lopate, and this is WNYC, AM, FM, and WNYC.org. We all experience pressure in our daily lives to downplay the characteristics about ourselves that could make blending into the mainstream more difficult. We feel pressure to cover up in order to fit in. But should we accept this pressure as a fact of social life? Kenji Yoshino, the Deputy Dean for Intellectual Life and Professor of Law at Yale Law School, believes the demand society places on each of us to cover aspects of our true selves poses a hidden and very dangerous threat to our civil rights, a threat American civil rights law has largely ignored. His new book, Covering, The Hidden Assault on Our Civil Rights, is published by Random House, and I'm pleased to have him here at the Leonard Lopate Show today. Welcome, Kenji.
Thank you.
You know, I am fascinated by your new book, but I'm also a little bit curious about what exactly a dean for intellectual life does.
Well, many people have that question because it sounds like something that's out of Harry Potter. So the Defense Against Dark Arts job was taken, so I took this one. It's basically a dean for academic life, so anything that doesn't pertain directly to our curriculum, but that pertains to our intellectual life, like workshops or fellowships or guest speakers and things like that under my or in my bucket.
Sounds like a cool job. I'm wondering, too, how did the term covering first come to be used? It was comes from another book?
Exactly. It's sociologist Irving Goffman's word, and I'm a huge Goffman fan. He's such a creative, wonderful thinker. But it comes from a 1963 book that he wrote called Stigma, and he used it in order to describe how people downplay known identities. So his big example, or one of his big examples, was how FDR used to make sure he was sitting behind a desk before his cabinet came in. And it wasn't that he was passing, because everyone knew he was in a wheelchair, but he was covering, downplaying his disability and making sure that his more conventionally presidential qualities were in the forefront.
Well, I noticed that you, in your book, you talk about those terms, and I'm wondering if you could really define them for us. You have covering, which is the title of your book, and you also have passing, which I associate with racial passing, like a light-skinned black person passing as a white person. And then there's converting, which I, you know, think of someone converting from one religion to another, but you're using it in broader terms, all those.
Yes, exactly. I'm delighted to clarify those terms. And it might actually be most helpful to do it, as I do in the book, by just taking one group and following how these three demands have been made on one group. And the group that I follow are gays and lesbians. And so I retell the history of gay rights by saying that the history of gay rights can be retold as a history of resistance to weakening demands for assimilation. So through the middle of the 20th century, the most ascendant demand was a demand to convert, and conversion is you will become straight. So, you know, gay people were being driven into conversion therapy, you know, electroshock therapy, lobotomies, all kinds of horrific things were being done to them in order to flip them over into becoming straight. And so that's conversion. The underlying identity is changed or transformed. Then, as we head into the end of the 20th century, the demand made on gays and lesbians shifts from conversion to passing. And passing is where the underlying identity remains the same, but it is masked to the rest of the world. So Don't Ask, Don't Tell would be a classic example of this, where the military has said, you can be gay in the military, it's just that you can't be gay and out. Right? And then finally, kind of at the turn of the millennium, we're seeing another shift, again, an emphasis. None of these shifts are categorical in nature, towards the covering demand. And the covering demand is you can be gay, and you can even say that you're gay, but just make it easy for us to ignore your homosexuality. So this would be, I'm fine with gay people, but why do they have to hold hands in public? Or I'm fine with gay people, but, you know, why can't they be more straight acting? Or, you know, why do they have to be so militant or strident? So all the variety of ways in which we downplay our identities in order to make other people more comfortable with those identities would fall under the rubric of covering when those identities are known.
So the thing that I was fascinated by, too, in your book, Covering, is the idea that the law tends to protect at this point in our legal history who you are rather than how you act. And something I was fascinated by, I'm African-American, and there's sort of an urban legend, I think, among a lot of African Americans that there was a woman who wore her hair in cornrows to work, and she was sued. I mean, she sued the company because they fired her because she had these cornrows. And in the urban legend, she wins the suit. She gets to keep her job and she gets to wear her cornrows. But that's not true. Could you talk about that case a little bit and in how her being black was protected, but her sort of acting black wasn't?
Absolutely. The case in question is a case called Rogers versus American Airlines. Renee Rogers was an African-American woman who worked for American Airlines as an operations agent. And American Airlines issued a no braided hair policy. And so she was sanctioned under this policy. And she refused to stand down. She said, this is part of my identity, and therefore I want to wear cornrows. And the American Airlines resisted. And so she finally brought a lawsuit here in New York in federal court. And the court said, in a very interesting decision, you know, you have the right to be protected against race discrimination, but discrimination on the basis of cornrows is not race discrimination. And it made two different arguments. First of all, it denied that there was any connection in between cornrows and African-American identity, saying that the style had first been popularized in the film 10, and it was only after that that Renee Rogers started wearing cornrows to work. I call this a Baudelaire defense, right? So, but as if sort of realizing that this was not its most persuasive argument, the court went on to say there's a difference between immutable and mutable traits. Hmm. And so if you're being fired because of something you can't change, like your skin color, then you're going to win your employment discrimination lawsuit on the basis of race in a hot second. But if it's something within your control, then you have to cover it or assimilate. And in fact, American Airlines even went so far as to say, you know, what can you cover up your hair with a hairpiece? So, like, you can wear your cornrows so long as you put on a hairpiece over it.
Something over it. Wow. So the urban legend is not true. She did not win her case.
She did not win her case.
I'm lucky enough to have Kenji Yoshino in the studio today, and I'm Danielle Smith in for Leonard Lopate. Kenji, I'm also wondering about your background. You were raised in both the United States and in Japan. And as your book is very personal, I feel comfortable getting all in your personal business.
Absolutely.
So I'm wondering, how did... Did you have kind of a dual identity as a child? You know, the Japanese side of you, the American side of you?
Yes, definitely. And I think that a large part of this book arises from my experience in both countries. Because one of the things that's really interesting in Japan, if you are of Japanese descent, is that Japanese people, Japanese nationals, have a very hard time understanding where you fit in, because if you look Japanese and you speak Japanese, because I grew up speaking Japanese, mm-hmm. they often just treat you as Japanese. But at some point, there's always that kind of moment of betrayal where you do something that isn't Japanese, you know. And so the way something in the way that you walk or the way that you talk or some mannerism or expression that you use will tip them off to the fact that you're not Japanese. And the sense of sort of insider-outsider distinctions on ethnic grounds are so powerful in Japan that at the minute you slip over the line, there is this incredible sense of a betrayal. And I think that that's really what one of the things that got me thinking about this, Danielle, in the sense that in Japan, sort of, I had the bloodlines and the skin color of a Japanese person, but something about my behavior made me not code as Japanese.
It's a little off a little bit.
Exactly. And so that made me think, like, well, is this true across the board? Is there is there always a performative dimension to race? You know, is there always a, even in the United States, so, you know, is somebody going to code as more African-American if they wear cornrows, to go back to the earlier case, you know, or is someone going to code as less African-American or less Asian-American, you know, if they engage in quote-unquote white acting behavior, right? So it struck me that a lot of racial identity is behavioral in nature as opposed to being simply a biological characteristic.
And you think that this can be... I don't want to sound crass, but you feel like this can be dealt with by the legal system? You feel like, because a lot of your book, and I loved it, and it was, you know, it was personal as well as full of all these great cases, these legal cases that totally make a great case. But I'm wondering, is a lot of this psychology more so than, you know, something that we should go get a lawyer to take care of?
That's a wonderful question. And I mean, one of the dominant arguments in the book is that we can experience something as a civil rights harm, even if we can't find a legal remedy for it. So I think that oftentimes...
I think you should say that again.
Okay.
Okay.
We should experience some things as civil rights harms, even though we can't find a legal remedy for them.
Mm.
So oftentimes, like take the Cornrows case. I think that many Americans who listen to the Cornrows case have a deep ambivalence about it in the sense that they read that case and they kind of smell racism in the air. Like they think, why would you go after? Because American kept saying to Renee Rogers, like, why is this so important to you? This is so trivial. And she says right back to them, well, if it's so trivial, why are you making it a condition of my employment, right? So, I mean, at some level, I think that many Americans sort of look at this and they say, something just doesn't smell right here. Something is just not okay in this interaction. And race is in play in an important way.
Well, let me play devil's advocate. Whether it was the Cornrows case or a case affecting a gay American or a disabled American, I'm wondering, as the employer, just to play devil's advocate here, not that all employers are devils, but just to play devil's advocate, what if I say, I just really don't want cornrows in my office. I feel like it's going to cost me a lot of money to build ramps to go upstairs so that it's wheelchair accessible. I feel like there's a guy named Steve in my office, and I don't want him to wear pink shirts every day just because I don't like that, and I own this business. What is their side in this?
Right. Again, great question. I mean, I think that we have to start from a baseline where you're starting from, which is to say that in the United States, we have employment at will. So that it means that the employer gets to control the conditions of his work environment. But even though the general rule is employment at will, Danielle, we have some carve-outs for that, that say there are certain bases on which employers can't discriminate, namely race, sex, disability, religion, color, and a few other characteristics, age, mm-hmm. To some extent. And when we're dealing with those limited number of characteristics, then the employer doesn't have discretion. That's what the work of civil rights has been, is to sort of take certain things off the table as things that the employer can exclude people from the workplace based upon. And so that makes the discussion of the person who wants to wear a pink shirt very different from the description of the person who wants to wear cornrows or what have you, because the cornrows code much more as racial than the pink shirt probably does in most circumstances. So I guess what I'm trying to say, to clarify, is to say, on the one hand, I feel like...
Kenji, let me just interrupt you for a second, because
sure.
We've got to go to break. But I want to remind everyone that we are speaking with Professor Kenji Yoshino, who wrote Covering, A Hidden Assault on Our Civil Rights for Random House. Stay with me for a quick break, and then... we will be back. Hey, I am Danielle Smith, and I'm in for Leonard Lopez today here on WNYC. We have Professor Kenji Yoshino in talking about his book Covering, and he wants to pick right up where he left off.
Thanks, Danielle. So I just wanted to go back and say, basically what we're facing in the United States right now is a shift, a generational shift in the way that discrimination is occurring. So it used to be that employers would say, no racial minorities, no women, no individuals with disabilities, no gays, no religionists allowed.
It had to be a fun world to live in.
Yes, exactly. A paradise, suddenly disguised. And now we've flipped over to a new model that says, increasingly, although obviously there are some workplaces in which first-generation discrimination still takes place, but now we're into a generation where it's much more likely that employers will say, of course we don't discriminate against individuals categorically in those ways. But what you oftentimes see is that now it's a subset of the original group that refuses to assimilate to dominant norms that gets sanctioned or excluded in some way. So African-Americans are welcome, but not African-Americans who wear cornrows. You know, Latinos are welcome, but not Latinos who lapse into Spanish in English-only workplaces. Women are welcome, but not mothers. You know, gays are welcome, but not gays who flaunt. And so this idea of if you want to work here and you're a minority of some kind, you have to downplay or mute your difference is a phenomenon that I'm calling covering. And we were just talking about the extent to which we could understand covering as a harm because you were rightly saying that the law generally makes a distinction in between things you can change and things that you can't. You know, the covering demand is usually directed towards cultural traits, which we can change, and so therefore, no harm, no foul. What's the harm here? And I was responding to that by saying that American civil rights has taken certain classifications off the table as permissible grounds for employers to discriminate on the basis of, namely race, sex, and what have you. And that from my perspective, the demand to assimilate to dominant norms, so that is a form of discrimination on the basis of race or on the basis of sex or on the basis of sexual orientation. So when an employer says, you know, oh, we like African Americans, we're going to hire lots of African Americans, or we like women, and we're going to hire lots of women, but you notice that if you look at the partnership track, you know, the women who are making it are the women who don't have children or the women who downplay their childcare responsibilities at work, at some point that becomes a sex discrimination issue for me that should be redressed under the law.
Something I also felt was important about your book is the idea that you do not feel that this is necessarily just a quote-unquote minority issue, that this affects everyone, straight white males even. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Exactly. So when I lecture about covering, oftentimes I get a question from what I call the kind of angry straight white male in the audience, you know, because this person is usually a straight white man, and or I assume he's straight, and is usually very angry as well. And he says, you know, this is just whining and it's a culture of complaint and this is what's wrong with America today because, you know, why shouldn't, you know, African Americans or women or Asian Americans or gays have to downplay the cultural attributes that are associated with their identity? It's one thing if they get fired for their skin color or what have you, but if it's behavioral, they should have to downplay it in the same way that I have to downplay all of my traits. So this person usually gives an example of some trait that he holds that he has to cover in the public sphere. So he'll say something like, well, I'm depressed, or I come from a working class background and we haven't had the conversation about class in the United States yet, or, you know, I survived incest, or, you know, this or that or what have you. And I think I really surprise them when I agree, which is to say one of the reasons why I want to move beyond the law in this conversation is that when we're talking about the law, the remedies, because law is such a meat axe, the kinds of remedies that we can offer internal to the law, and by meat axe I mean it's blunt and it's violent and, you know,
and
it has really coercive consequences. Mm-hmm. The kinds of harms we're going to be able to remedy are really narrow in nature. But once we move outside of the law into the realm of culture and the kinds of conversations that we have in our day-to-day lives and the ways in which we interact with each other in these kind of minute daily ways, in the places where really tolerance is made and unmade, you know, in the workplace, by the water cooler, on the playground, you know, in the classroom, all those kinds of daily places, not the courtroom, you know, then I think that we can be much more broad in the way that we construe civil rights. And there, you know, when an individual says, this part of my identity is really important to me and I have to suppress it for no good reason, I am actually very sympathetic to that. And I'm not saying everyone should be able to kind of follow their bliss and nudists should be able to come into the workplace and that kind of thing. What I am saying is that when somebody is asked to assimilate, that they should be able to draw the other person into a reason-forcing conversation, which is to say that the other person who's demanding the assimilation should be required to give a reason that would stand up to public discourse for why that is being required. So the general American gestalt of if you can assimilate, you must, because this is a melting pot, is what I'm critiquing, because that too reflexively assumes that if you can assimilate, you must assimilate. Whereas what I'm saying is if somebody makes a demand for assimilation, they at least have to back that with a reason. And if the reason is something like, you know, I'm uncomfortable around culture X or group X, then that's not enough.
Now, I like the idea of a reason-giving conversation, but I do want to get out of the courtroom for a minute and go back to the fact that your book covering is not just about the courtroom and it's not just about, it is about civil rights, but it's also about just your life. And I'm wondering, did your parents ever ask you to cover? And I'm also wondering, don't parents teach their children in every way they can communicate to them, like, you have to cover, but they don't say it, but they teach you sort of how to act and how to be in the world. And aren't we, in fact, teaching our kids in many ways to cover?
Well, I think it's a lot of the responses that I've gotten to this work has been from parents and the kind of it strikes me that one of the most poignant things about being a parent is that you have to draw the line in between helping your child to be themselves and helping them to get on in the world, which often means assimilation. So I actually hear both sides of that from parents, which is to say, on the one hand, parents do ask their children to cover all the time. You asked about my own parents. My own parents' mantra was be 100% American in America and 100% Japanese in Japan. So the message that I got was wherever I was, as opposed to assimilating to the dominant view. And I don't obviously fault them for that. I think that that speaks to the side that you were talking to, which is to say parents want good things for their children, and so therefore they want them to get along in the world. And a large part of that is fitting in. But on the other hand, my parents also insisted that I be myself, so that they were really insistent on helping me, find what I was good at and my own gifts, and to make sure that I was, standing up for myself and articulating myself in the world. And so I think that I also got a message not to cover myself along those dimensions.
I'm Danielle Smith. I'm in for Leonard Lope today, and we have Kenji Yoshino, author of the new book, Covering. It's published by Random House. Something else you talk about, just to change the subject a tiny bit, is you talk about how the quote-unquote selective uptake of certain minority cultures is really about the consumer, not true acceptance of these cultures. And what do you mean by that?
Right. So oftentimes when I talk about covering, another point of resistance or pushback is to say, well, actually, what are you complaining about? Because there's so many dimensions of minority culture that people take up all the time. So if you look in the ethnic context, if you look at, Thai food or rap music or, whatever, we see ethnic minorities making their imprint on their culture all the time. Even with respect to gays, we see Queer Eye for the Straight Guy or, gays pushing the culture forward with couture or style or, interior design or what have you. And so I accept all of that, but what troubles me about that is to say that the uptake of those cultural traits is often driven by what the mainstream consumer finds to be interesting. So if the mainstream consumer doesn't, so in the gay context, if the straight consumer finds gay interior design to be cool or interesting or helps them, express their own metrosexual self, then that's fine. There's no problem with that. But when it gets to something that is less important to the mainstream consumer but deeply important to the gay person, say gay marriage, then the culture hasn't actually trickled over. And so what I'm bothered by is that too much of what we accept about minority cultures is driven by the mainstream consumer rather than about according the minority individual their own dignitary rights to that culture.
And speaking of the mainstream, is there a mainstream? I don't know if there is a mainstream, and I'm interested in what you think about that.
Great. Again, a wonderful question, which is to say, I think that narrowly speaking, there is a mainstream in the sense that if you pick any particular identity, you can often play it off against a mainstream culture. So I'm comfortable saying that straights are more mainstream than gays. I'm comfortable saying that, whites are more mainstream than many ethnic minorities in this country. But I see what you're getting at in the sense that once we start talking about the mainstream in more abstract terms, the word starts to lose meaning because the mainstream is such a shifting coalition of identities, and we all hold so many identities that all of us are outside of the mainstream in some way.
And are all of us in it in some way?
And all of us are in it in some way.
Okay.
Yes, yes. But I actually don't view that as a liability. I actually view that as a great hope for my theory, because if all of us are outside of the mainstream in some way, that means all of us cover in some way. And so all of us can make common cause around the demand to cover. So Gloria Steinem once said that the oftentimes we needed to come up with a name for a social phenomenon before we could see it and solve it, as a problem. And so her example of this was sexual harassment. Sexual harassment is obviously going on all the time, but it wasn't until Catherine MacKinnon and others, located it, identified it, and named it that we began to be able to see it as a social problem.
And so you are naming covering?
Yes, and this is like a word I want to hammer into the vernacular.
Covering, covering, covering.
We can just keep saying that
over
until the
and over
end of the
again.
Show. Exactly. But I think that one of the exciting things for me about the covering idea which again, you know, for people who are just joining us, is the idea that we downplay, you know, critical parts of our own identity in order to fit into the mainstream, is that if everybody does this, suddenly civil rights becomes about us all, that we all have a stake in our own authenticity and a culture that respects our authenticity and our human flourishing. And so this is something that could include us all rather than being about a particular sociological group.
Now, but I'm wondering, is it realistic, though, to expect that we can ever all live our authentic lives and our authentic selves? Was there ever a time in history? I mean, are we thinking of Haight-Ashbury in the 1970s? Are we thinking of the West Village in the late 70s? I mean, what does it look like in this country if we're all living our authentic self?
Well, I always think that freedom is a project that admits of degrees, right? So we're never going to have total freedom, and that's something that we just have to grapple with as human beings, you know. So we just have to suck that one up. But, you know, at the same time, I feel that there are significant degrees of freedom such that we can be more free or less free. And there's an interesting way in which my model is not a kind of bohemian kind of anything goes kind of community, because I'm not really an anything goes kind of guy. But as you probably have intuited, much to my own chagrin. But I do think that it's possible to allow people to exercise certain freedoms that I feel like are fundamental to all human beings. So just to give you an example, and I believe that this is true even under law. So to give you an example, you know, in 2004, the Supreme Court said that Congress could require the states to make all of their courthouses wheelchair accessible. Mm-hmm. But it didn't do that, Danielle, on the basis of the fact that the individuals in question were disabled. It did it on the basis that all of us as Americans have the right to access the courthouse. Right. So instead of framing it as something that was particular to a particular group of, oh, there are these people who are disabled, we have to feel sorry for them and accommodate them. Rather, what the Supreme Court did was to say, we all have this right to participate in our political and civic life. And part of that means that you have to get into the courtroom and have access to it. And if that means building a ramp, then, you know, build a ramp.
Build a ramp. Know. We have Kenji Yoshino in today, and if you have a question for him about civil rights, about identity, about what it's like to be the dean of intellectual life at Yale, or a comment, anything, do call in at 212-433-9692. We're at 212-433-9692.
You're not going to let me off the hook for that.
I want everyone to call in and ask you all kind of stuff. I'm wondering, speaking again of your job up at Yale, do students come to you saying, hey, Professor Yoshino, I want to uncover my authentic self. You're an expert on this. Help me out.
Students actually, not in those terms, but I mean, they don't come to me and say it in that blunt of a way, but I feel that students come to me all the time and ask for advice about how to carry themselves within the law. So, and what's interesting about this is that it spans the entire spectrum of identity. So it's not just, you know, gay students who come to me and say, you know, I'm out of the closet, but how gay can I be? Can I put it on my resume? Can it be on my transcript? Will I get sanctioned and not get a job, you know, if I uncover myself in that way? But it's also conservative students who say, you know, this is a very liberal environment. You know, the law school is, most American law schools are. How open can I be about the fact that I'm ideologically way to the right, you know, without getting sanctioned? Or religious students say to me, can I declare that I'm a believer without my my intellectual reputation going on a 25% discount because this is such a secular environment? So this, again, sort of underscores to me how universal the desire for authenticity is and how universal the demand to cover it is as well.
You know something? I want the WNYC audience to bear with me because this is my first time guest hosting, but we're actually going to try to go to phones here. So I think I am going to press a green button and hope that I find Mary from Westfield. Is this Mary?
Yes, it is. Hi.
How are you?
Good, good. And I'm really enjoying the show. My question was related to what you were just talking about. What would you do about conservative Christians who want to proselytize in the workplace? You know, say they want to try to convert some Jews. I mean, what do you do?
Can you hear the question there?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Well, I would actually, I mean, it would depend on the degree to which the proselytization proselytization occurred, excuse me. But to the extent that it was respectful and an attempt to persuade, then I would absolutely permit it in the sense that, well, first of all, it wouldn't be within my bailiwick to forbid it. But the baseline thing that you're getting at here, which is really an important point, is to say that oftentimes people are worried about allowing people to uncover themselves because they worry that such uncovering will lead them to convert other people. So again, if you go back to the gay context, we see this all the time in the gay context where courts are often very leery about letting parents who are open about their homosexuality have custody over children because they're worried that flaunting, quote unquote, on the part of the parents will lead the children to convert to homosexuality. In both cases, both the gay case and the religion case, my baseline question is, do we believe that the underlying identity is a legitimate or valid identity? And in both cases, I would say yes. So at that point, if we believe the underlying identity is a valid identity, then we shouldn't worry about whether or not other people are being persuaded to convert to that identity. So if something is okay to be, then it has to also be okay to show and take pride in the various ways that uncovering entails.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Mary, for calling in. We appreciate you reaching out from New Jersey.
Let's
reach out really quickly to Dakan, I think, in the Bronx. Dakan,
Hello,
are you there?
Hi, yes. I'm actually in Brooklyn. Sorry.
Oh, you're in Brooklyn. Okay.
No problem. My question for the guest is, my belief is that in our individual identity is often more of a cultural construction than something that we're essentially born with. And I'm wondering how that plays into his notion that there is no— does he believe there's a limit to what an individual can express as an individual, or that there are any cultural norms that we all must sort of follow to be considered part of our culture or society?
That's a great question. So I'm sorry to interrupt you, Dakan, but is there a cultural norm, I think, is what Dakan is asking?
Absolutely. And, you know, we would be foolish to, you know, I would be foolish to inveigh against assimilation all the way down the line, because part of what it means to be a human being is to assimilate, right? So to speak a language, a common language, is to assimilate, to wear clothes, to obey the law, to have manners. All these things are acts of assimilation. So I'm not setting my face against all assimilation. Rather, I'm inveighing against a cultural norm that moves in the opposite direction and says that all assimilation is good. So part of the idea of the reason-forcing conversation is that if the person making the demand can come up with a reason that is universal in the way that you're gesturing towards, then that's a permissible form of assimilation. So if I say, well, you know, I want to actually, you know, be a nudist in the workplace, and someone says, well, we actually have a general culture that, you know, requires clothing in the workplace and it would be too distracting or disruptive or whatever, then I would generally accept that, you know, as, you know, something that we need to do in order to live in society. And so civilization often entails assimilation, but there are certain grounds of assimilation that I find problematic and I can't see a reason for other than the kinds of discrimination that we've already outlawed, like racism, sexism, what have you.
Thank you so much for calling, Dakan. We have Hemi actually calling, another person from New Jersey, from Princeton. Hemi, here you go.
Hi. I really enjoy your show. My question is, I am an Indian, of Asian Indian, who settled in the United States for about 11 years. And the area where I live in, there's a large Indian population, and we very often see elderly Indian women wearing saris. And one complaint that we often hear is Indians aren't assimilating, you know, because the outfit, they stand out. The problem is my 65-year-old mother, who has never worn anything but a sari, she comes here just for once to visit me. I mean, she shouldn't be asked to wear, you know, anything else besides. She feels
so
more comfortable in a sari.
You see what I'm saying? You feel like Asian Indians should be allowed to wear saris and not hear any criticism about it? Is that what you're saying?
Exactly.
Okay. I'm wondering what Kenji thinks about that.
Right. Absolutely. I'm absolutely with you. Like, I think that at the point where we say we celebrate diversity of skin color and that it's all right to be an Indian, then why wouldn't we, you know, permit cultural expressions of pride in that identity unless there were some reason on the other side not to permit that. And I don't see, you know, your mother is failing to assimilate as being enough of a reason. So assimilation in and of itself can never be the justification. There has to be something more robust than that in order to justify that demand to cover.
Hi, I'm Danielle Smith, and I'm in for Leonard Lopez today. We have Professor Kenji Yoshino here from Yale, and he is the author of a new book. It's called Covering, which is an awesome book. And right now we're going to reach out to Robert, another caller from New Jersey. New Jersey is very interested in your book, I think. Professor Yoshino, let's go to Robert. Robert, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go right ahead.
Professor Yoshino, I've never been so involved in a program on NPR as I am with this discussion.
Thank you.
I feel it relates to me and many people that I know. I'm 72 years old, have run my own business on my own for many, many years, at least in significant part because I wanted to remove myself from the alpha male aggression that took place in the workplaces that I had to inhabit in my younger years. And it certainly, I never thought of it as something like covering, but I felt that I was both trying to cover my true self and trying very much to protect that self in that covering, but never reveal that I was in fact trying to be protective.
And so what do you...
Well, it's something that has attracted my attention for years. I'm thinking of the movie Glengarry Glen Ross.
Okay.
And I'm thinking of other articles that I have read on this subject about aggressive male behavior in the workplace.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And that it's a very difficult thing to control because it's subjective.
So I'm wondering, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Robert, but I'm wondering, what do you think about that, Professor Yoshino?
Well, I'm actually, you know, I just kind of want to say kind of right on to that, because I think that this underscores a kind of important subtlety, which is that oftentimes covering demands, I mean, I think that the demand to be aggressive in the workplace has most frequently been articulated by women, you know, in the workplace, who are asked to conform to male norms and often resist that or are seen to be resistant to that. What the caller is underscoring in a really helpful way is that when we have a workplace where people are more free to engage in their own expression of personality, oftentimes we come to see that the demands may that are made on others often also kind of pinch on the group that is supposedly protected by that norm. So if we generally associate aggression with men and we think all men want to be aggressive, that actually isn't the case. You know, many men don't want to be aggressive
exactly.
in the workplace, and many men don't, you know, feel that they're being cast into a role that is uncomfortable for them because, say, they might be more empathetic than the average man, or they may actually want to engage in more collegial relationships. So I think, again, what you're pointing to is the universality of the covering demand that says this isn't just a group-based issue, but it's something that could affect all of us.
Robert, I want to thank you for calling in. Right now, we're going to go to Amy in Manhattan, who seems like she has a problem, Kenji, with the use of the word cover.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi.
Amy.
Hello, yes?
How are you? Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks, Danielle. How are you?
Just fine.
Yeah, that's one of the things I wanted to address. I've just seen too much of this. It's that usage of it sounds very academic to me, and I think if you really want to get it into the culture, that it may not be the best term to use.
So you got some suggestions, Amy?
That's
what I want to know.
I'm up with some, and I'm actually an editor, so I should be able
okay,
to.
Okay, so come on, get the thesauri out, and let's pick one.
I
like covering,
right now,
but
sorry.
What do you think it sounds negative? Do you think it sounds too broad? Like, what is it?
Yeah, I think it has implications. It's trying to take a word that to most people means something else and stretch it in a way that I think is going to be a little hard for people outside of the academic world to have it come natural to them.
Okay, well, I don't know what Professor Y is going to say to that, but
I
what
understand.
Do you got?
Well,
thank you for calling in, Amy.
Can I say one more?
You know something? We have like 8,000 calls, so we appreciate you calling in.
But another reason, but anyway, okay, go ahead.
Okay, thanks so much.
I mean, I guess to that, I would just say, I'm actually a little curious to know what the dominant meaning of covering would be to her, because I don't actually see it as a word that has brought, except for perhaps musical covering, like you cover a CD.
Cover a song or something like that,
I don't think that,
that
people will be confused, you know, on that ground. So I'm a little bit puzzled by that. I also want to say that, you know, oftentimes words that we're trying to hammer into the vernacular don't sound like, you know, they're going to have broad currency until they actually get into the vernacular.
I mean, so, like you were saying, sexual harassment, that sounds big and like 80 syllables. And
yeah, who knew?
And you know? Now it's like everyone knows it and everyone says it.
Exactly.
We're going to wrap up in a second, Kenji. And I'm just wondering, is there anything that you wanted to leave our listeners with? Anything that is, if you have that two or three sentence thing that says what your book is about and not even so much why they should go get it, even though I do think everyone should go get it, but just what are you leaving us with in covering in your new book?
Thanks, Danielle. I guess I would make 3 points. I mean, the first point would be that I'm trying to name a phenomenon with this word covering. So it jumps off of the discussion we were just having, is that the idea of covering, which is that we all have to downplay parts of our authentic selves in order to fit into the mainstream, is something that I really would like us to have a national conversation about, and I would like us to hammer it into the vernacular such that it's as common as the word passing or as the word the closet. I guess the second thing is to say that sometimes covering can be a civil rights issue, and that when people are asked to downplay protected identities such as their racial identity or their identities as women, their identities as gays, etc., oftentimes what's motivating that demand is continued animus against the group. And so the demand that minorities downplay aspects of their identity is often the form that discrimination is taking today. And then third and finally, I would say that the solution here is not just legal, but also cultural. And so therefore, we should recognize that this is something that we all do, but also recognize that the law may be limited in the redress that it can offer, and that the responsibility is with us as citizens to engage each other in these reason-forcing conversations.
Kenji Yoshino, Professor Kenji Yoshino, thank you so much for being with us today. I'm Danielle Smith. I'm in for Leonard Lopate. And I also wanted to mention that Professor Yoshino will be giving a lecture at NYU's D'Agostino Hall at 110 West 3rd Street on Tuesday the 24th at 6 o'clock. He's great. You guys will love him. Thank you so much. Yale's lucky to have you.
Thank you so much.